Support comes from Mosby Building Arts, providing exterior solutions for homes with faded, cracked, or outdated siding. Details at callmosby.com.
Melissa Price-Smith knew from the day she interviewed to be appointed prosecuting attorney in St. Louis County that she wanted to be elected to the post. She says she's earned a full term in office by working to bring down violent crime, thinking differently about conditions of bond to help defendants get the services they need, and eliminating a backlog of cases left by her predecessor. Price-Smith is one of two Democrats seeking the party's nomination for the post. We'll also be talking to her primary opponent. The winner faces a Libertarian candidate in November. Price-Smith joins me next on the latest episode of Politically Speaking. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, the definitive show about Missouri politics.
We've seen a county government that has had smooth and steady leadership, and I think we're on a good path right now.
I realized the office needed a prosecutor to run it.
And we have a better solution of addressing those needs.
I don't think it's about a popularity contest. What I think it about is it's time for change.
Working together across city and county, across political affiliations, that we can start to find overlapping goals.
I had some moments where I had to, lean into my courage.
You'll see us work together on areas of agreement, and you'll see us have difficult conversations when we don't agree.
And welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm your host, Rachel Lipman. Joining me today in studio is
Melissa Price-Smith.
She is the prosecuting attorney in St. Louis County and is running for a full term in that office. And I know that we have spoken in the past, but this is your first time on the podcast, and we like to give those individuals a chance to introduce themselves. So introduce yourselves to our listeners.
Well, good morning. My name is Melissa Price-Smith, and I am the current prosecutor of St. Louis County. I've been in the office for 18 years as an assistant prosecuting attorney, but I was appointed to complete Wesley Bell's term about a year and a half ago, and that's the position I've been in since January 3rd, 2025.
And if I remember correctly, you did not take a traditional path into law and prosecuting.
That is quite true. That is quite true. I grew up in a ballet company, actually. Spent a lot of years and a lot of time growing up in a serious ballet company with my twin sister, Metropolitan Ballet of St. Louis. I think it created a lot of discipline, which I'm grateful for. Moved on to expand my dance career to a cruise ship in Las Vegas before coming home to go to law school. So I'm so grateful for those experiences. And after that, decided to pursue a new dream of law school.
As you mentioned, you came into this role as an appointee of then-Governor Mike Parson when Wesley Bell got elected to Congress. You almost immediately said you would seek this full term. How and why had you made that decision so quickly after being sworn into the role?
Well, when I decided to throw my hat in and to interview with the governor for this position, I had already been in the office, like I said, about 18 years. So when I made the decision for this role, I knew immediately that because when I say I stepped forward, it was really me and my colleagues and law enforcement and community partners we had worked with and families I had worked with. I had stepped forward not on my own, but with a lot of people I had spoken to. So we all had a lot of ideas on how to continue to build the office and so many things that we wanted to do to make St. Louis County safer. So when I made the commitment to throw my hat in for this position, it was a long-term commitment. And I'm so proud of the things we've done. I want to keep doing it.
You had been in the office, as you mentioned, working as a line prosecutor and section leader for about 20 years. But being in that top sort of management role is just a whole different beast. And I'm wondering what you learned most about the function of the office after getting into that top spot.
Well, first of all, the way you said it is the best way. It is a whole different beast. Well, first of all, one of the things that I am grateful to say I've learned in this role that I am smart enough to know what I don't know. So the most important thing that I did in this role was to surround myself with some incredible people to lead the office and be in the office. It also gave me an advantage. You know, when I was a line prosecutor, I did every type of crime, low-level misdemeanors, robberies, burglaries, guns and drugs. But the majority of those years as an assistant prosecutor, I did sexual assault and child abuse. And the thing about that was I loved what I was doing. It was an honor to work with those victims. But I worked in a vacuum. I was very focused on just my cases. Being in this role, a huge advantage and a huge lesson I've learned, as I've been able to step back, I realize how the prosecutor's office can take a huge role, not only in prosecution, in keeping St. Louis County safe and holding violent offenders accountable, but I've realized that our office can also be a part of the solution. So in stepping back, I realize we can be a part of the communities, the high schools, which we are very involved in, to keep especially young people out of the system. And that's been very eye-opening to me and a real inspiration and some real changes I've made in that respect.
Tell me about how you would say you've gotten the prosecutor's office focused on front-end solutions rather than just the back-end prosecution.
Absolutely. When we get a case, when we get a defendant who comes to us, a rapist, a murderer, an assault first, all we can do is prosecute at that point. That's our job. We can't help anymore. But when I realized, like I said, we can be a part of the solution, we, first of all, are out in the community absolutely every time we get the chance, several times a week. And one of the realities of that is we want people to know what we do. We want to answer questions. But more importantly, we want to listen. We want to hear what communities need. We also are very aware that there are certain areas in St. Louis County, certain communities that don't trust us. There's been years of just things that have occurred in St. Louis County where there are communities who don't trust us. So we spend a lot of time in those communities to listen and see what we can do to rebuild that trust. One of the things we do to really be a part of the solution, though, is we spend a lot of time in high schools. And when I say we speak in high schools, we don't just say, hey, I'm a prosecutor, this is what I do. We have real talk. How many of you are 18? How many of you are younger? We talk about real cases. We actually get a waiver ahead of time from the teacher. We can get a little graphic. We talk about real cases that young people have been involved in, even where they stepped into it accidentally but didn't know. We talk about things that teenagers these days, one of the things they all do and they think it's funny and embarrassing is send naked and sexual pictures of each other. They think it's funny. They think it's embarrassing. We explain it's also distribution of child pornography. But we really get into some great talks about what do you do when you receive that picture? What do you not do when you receive that picture? We also talk about some cases, groups of friends where there have even been, due to alcohol and drugs, where rapes have occurred. What about the person who just blocks the door? What about the person who walks away? And the great thing about speaking to these high school students, when we start having what I like to call real talk, they start really talking. And I am so proud to say we have expanded the schools we have been into, that we're into. We're in Parkway, Rockwood. We are developing a wonderful partnership with Normandy and hoping to actually build our high school program to even small groups after our initial talks. We've been to Hazelwood. We're about to make a connection, and we've had some correspondence with Jennings and Ferguson Florissant, the alternative schools. So I think if these talks can lead to even one kid going right instead of left, it's totally worth it.
When you were talking to the communities, what were they telling you about what they needed from the office? And how did you maybe change the way that your office does things to address what you were hearing?
Well, Rachel, I'd actually like to tell you about one. About 6 months ago, I went to speak to a community in North County. It was a crowded meeting. And before I even started speaking, a gentleman raised his hand and said, before you start, I want you to know I don't like the police and I don't like you. And the first thing I thought when he said that was, I bet there are about 10 other people in this room who were thinking it but didn't say it.
At least 10.
At least 10, absolutely. And it really opened the door, though, for everyone to start talking. I would say that was one of the best neighborhood meetings we've ever had because we all spoke very honestly. They talked about why they didn't trust police, why they didn't trust the prosecutor's office. And we went through things. You know, the interesting thing that I heard from this community, this was a North County community, they actually wanted more police presence. They wanted stronger laws. We talked a lot about our new gun policy. They wanted a stronger gun policy. They were concerned about juveniles. And to have the discussion and, you know, and to give my number and say, let's keep the conversation going, it it really created some then great incentives to go back to my office and say, okay, let's talk about our gun policy. They need this. They see this and this and this in their community. So it helps immensely when, like I said, we have the real conversations with the community or the students and get their suggestions.
Part of that gun policy was an announcement that you would not allow probation as a sentence for most gun crimes. So homicide, aggravated assault, some felon in possession cases. Have you stuck to that promise?
Yeah, let me correct that.
Okay.
It's said several different ways. We are not doing straight probation on any gun crimes. And I want to explain.
And that is just where probation is the only sentence that they receive?
Yes. Thank you for saying that, Rachel. Yes, obviously, murders, assault first that are committed with a gun. That's not what we're talking about. What I'm talking about is the lower level gun crimes. There are so many of them, and we cannot ignore those. There are too many guns out there. So many people these days, and I'm not going to begin to start wondering why, solve their disputes with guns. We have got to send a message about our lower level gun crimes. And when I say that, I mean felon in possession, a felon who has a gun, not allowed to carry a gun, somebody who exhibits a gun in an angry or threatening manner, shooting into a car, shooting into a house, even if nobody's there and they don't hit anyone. There had been a trend in our office for these first-time offenses to just give straight probation. We can't do that. We have 270 pending homicides in our office. We cannot have a serious discussion about that if we are basically telling our future trigger pullers, okay, we're going to ignore what you're doing. We have to send a message that gun crimes are being taken more seriously. Now, is the 19-year-old who has a firearm with narcotics or with alcohol going to go to prison for 25 years? No. But he's going to sit down for a minute, even if it's 30-day shock in the county jail, even if it's 2-week shock. We have to send a message that we are not going to give straight probation and ignore it. Now, he may get 30-day shock and then get probation. But there's also going to be anger management with that. There's going to be no weapons. There's going to be any kind of treatment that he needs. We have to take a stronger stance on gun crimes in order to make St. Louis County safer.
Has it made a difference in the gun crimes that the police department measures?
I have not seen it at this point, but I have seen and heard from defense attorneys things like, I've already told my clients it's not straight probation anymore. So as the word gets out to these people who are very careless with guns and think it's okay to point a gun, to shoot a gun, and just be careless and think they can solve their disputes that way, the word is getting out, hey, it's not okay. And we are not just going to say, we're only taking our murders and our assaults seriously and we're going to ignore the rest of them. We're not ignoring the rest of them.
When you were prosecuting violent crimes in the office, were you seeing a connection between individuals who had a lot of gun crime, felon in possession, possessing with narcotics, who then did progress to more violent gun offenses?
What I have seen, and not in that specifically, what I have seen is offenders who are not held accountable, they are then, what is the word I'm looking for? They then progress and they are, I can't think of the word I'm looking for, but when they realize we're not taking...
Emboldened?
Emboldened. Thank you. They're emboldened. And I see a trend, and that's one of the reasons we reinstated our violent crime unit, because when we don't address things immediately, or these offenders are just given a slap on the wrist, they're emboldened. And they think, oh, I can do this because I know exactly what's going to happen. Nothing. Or, as I hear a lot of offenders say, I'm going to get paper and it's not a big deal. So they're very emboldened when they think the prosecutor's office is going to look away on these crimes that are often gateway to bigger and bigger crimes. So, yeah, in that respect, yes.
When Jason Rosenbaum, my colleague, and I sat down with you very shortly after you took office, you said, I'll be tough on crime, but I'm also going to look at each case individually. And I'm wondering how you might respond to critics who do include your opponent who say that the no straight probation for gun crimes isn't looking at each case on an individual basis.
Sure. Yeah. First of all, it is very, very important to look at each case on an individual basis. And not only I, but all 75 of our assistant prosecutors do that. Every case is a person. Every victim case is a victim and a family and different needs. I'll tell you this, Rachel. I also realize a lot of defendants are former victims. We have to look at every case on an individual basis, regardless of what the charge is. The fact that I say on gun crimes, we don't give straight probation. Like I said, there may be 20 or 30 days shock time just to send the message. As a prosecutor's office, we have to send the message. Does it mean we're not looking at cases on an individual basis? Absolutely not. As a prosecutor, we have to do the right thing, which means sometimes issue charges and send an individual to prison, sometimes recommend probation, sometimes dismiss or refuse a case. Every case is an individual basis from the very beginning of reviewing for possible charges and all throughout the process as we accumulate new evidence. Looking at every case, because we have a tough stance on crime and keeping St. Louis County safe, does not mean we don't look at cases on an individual basis. We do that every day with every case.
Where do you think residents of St. Louis County have most seen the fruits of your focus on violent crime?
I think they've absolutely seen it and feel safer on our stance on gun crimes. I absolutely know they've seen it in our reinstatement of our violent crime unit, which was suspended 2 years ago. Having a violent crime unit is essential. Say, for example, somebody steals a candy bar from Walgreens. That case does not need to be reviewed immediately. That's not a danger to the community. If someone commits...
It might be a danger to that candy bar, but...
That's right. If someone commits a violent crime, we need to have a violent crime unit ready, and we do now. When an officer comes in now on a violent crime, that case doesn't sit there for 3 days, 3 weeks. It is reviewed immediately for a charging decision. That individual's priors, pending cases, entire history is looked at. A charging decision is made immediately, because we are very, very aware that if those offenders are released and we review the case, I don't know, a month later, they're almost always going to have picked up additional crimes. So now, because we review those cases immediately, we immediately get those violent offenders off the streets, which is our job as the prosecutor.
What does the office consider a violent crime? Is it that FBI definition or?
Violent crime would be a robbery, a burglary first. Burglary first is entering an inhabitable structure while someone's there. Any crime committed with a weapon.
Murder, I'm assuming. Sexual assault.
Yeah. Murder, of course. And the sexual assaults all go to our sexual assault team.
Okay.
So that's a specialized unit. Any kind of assault first. Our domestic violence unit also reviews domestic violence first, second, third, immediately as well. But any crime that is anything of a violent nature, also resisting and running from police in a manner that also creates danger to anyone and everyone around them, which is Valentine's Law, where other people are at risk.
Is there data that you're using to back up what you think are the vibes that St. Louis County residents are feeling because of the focus on violent crime?
We are accumulating data. Do I have those numbers yet? No, I don't. I am confident that the data will show it, because our focus, when I say our focus, I mean everybody in the office. The focus of keeping St. Louis County safe is truly a genuine and dedicated focus every day. And I know the violent crime unit, the gun policy, the creation of the homicide unit are all helping keep St. Louis County safer.
Getting these cases reviewed faster does put more people into the population at the Buzz Westfall Justice Center. Are there efforts that you are doing to make sure that there's a balance out, to avoid overcrowding, to avoid disturbances, to avoid some of the problems that can happen when there are a lot of individuals or more individuals in a confined setting?
I am so glad you asked that. We have been working for about the last 5 months on talking about not only reducing the jail population, but what we can do, like I said earlier, to be a part of the solution. So what we have been doing the last several months is meeting with a lot of our community partners who are so incredible. And a lot of them originally, when we first met them, focused on reentry, helping individuals when they were going back into the community after a prison sentence. So we have been meeting with these groups and learning from them. But then what we've also asked them to do is we said, can you come with us to the beginning of the process and not just get involved in the reentry? So what we have asked them to do, and they have agreed, we are now working with them, and it is in real time right now, where what we are doing is when we have a bond review on someone who has just been confined, we now are looking at these community partners. Hey, what can they do to help this individual now? Do they have mental health problems? Do they need treatment? Do they need housing? Do they need jobs? And we're asking the judges, hey, judge, if we agree to this bond condition, can you order that this individual meet with Castle, meet with Keyway, meet with any of these organizations to get the help they need right now. Maybe there's never an entry into prison. Maybe that individual ultimately gets probation because the help they need was given in the beginning. It's giving our prosecutors tools. If one of our prosecutors is doing a bond hearing, I'm not talking about a violent case. Absolutely not. Doing a bond hearing and sees an individual, this person has a bunch of low-level nonviolent crimes. What is the core? What is the reason? And then they meet with someone from our pretrial department who says, well, I met with them and they have the following problems. Housing problems, addiction problems. So we say, okay, well, maybe we weren't going to agree to a bond before, but now we will. If they are ordered to get this treatment and get this help, then the individual is helped, the jail population goes down. I know this is going to work, but everybody has to be on board. Us, the public defenders, the judges.
You said the providers are on board. You're obviously on board. Are those other two players within the system as on board as they need to be?
The judges are definitely on board.
I'm not hearing the public defenders in that equation.
We're working on it. We're working on it.
Jason and I sat down and talked to you, like I mentioned, very shortly after you took office. I think it was like 2 or 3 days afterwards. And you put out several metrics that you said would be the way that you would measure success in a year. And I kind of want to go through a couple of them. One of them was a more efficient office. Is the St. Louis County Prosecutor's Office more efficient now?
100%.
How so?
We have recruited, I might have talked to you about this at some point, some really incredible veteran prosecutors to come and help us to create a more efficient office. We have created an entire mentorship program. Nobody goes to trial now just on their own. They have a sit down, they have a review with other attorneys, with supervisor attorneys about issues in the case, things that come up, they meet with their advocate. We have such a more efficient way before somebody goes to trial about being completely prepared. It is a much more efficient office. We've also have some great team leaders, and some of them are new in their position, about how to run these teams, how to counsel your attorneys, what advice to give them. And one of them is, like you brought up earlier, and I want to emphasize this, that every case is individual.
You are also looking for better partnerships with law enforcement, defense bar, and judges. Where are you seeing the fruits of the efforts there?
Yes. First of all, our relationship that we have even strengthened even more with the judges is very significant. We also have worked with Judge Hilton, our presiding judge, to create a second grand jury recently, which is very, very important to get cases moving through the system more quickly. Everybody's frustrated when cases take long, whether it be the victims' families, the attorney, the judges, the defendant's family. So creating a second grand jury, I'm very, very proud of that. That was through work with the judges because it doubles how quickly cases go through the system. We have strengthened our relationship with law enforcement immensely. And that is, again, by meeting with them. I want to make this clear. Law enforcement are our partners. They do the hard work. We carry their work in a file. But it doesn't mean we always agree. They apply on charges with us. Some people think that we issue every charge they bring. We issue about 50%.
Their grand jury will indict a ham sandwich is the old joke.
That's the old joke. It is. But the thing is, that's not the case. And we don't always issue their cases. We hold law enforcement to a high standard, and they hold us to a high standard. And that's how it should be. We have strengthened that relationship. In terms of defense attorneys, yes, absolutely. First of all, I have so much respect for defense attorneys. The only way our system works is if there's a good prosecutor on one side and a good defense attorney on the other side. That's what makes our country's system work. I can also say this publicly now. We have just hired one of the top criminal defense attorneys in St. Louis, and he starts with us in August. He's a great trial attorney. He's a great mentor. He'll bring a new perspective, and I am so excited to have him in our office.
It's not Scott Rosenblum, is it?
It's definitely not.
Okay. All right. Just want to make sure there. So a lot got made of the case backlog at the Circuit Attorney's Office in the city of St. Louis after Kim Gardner left. But I don't know that a lot of people realize there was a similar sized backlog in St. Louis County. If I remember, it was about 6,000 cases, although most of them were nonviolent. I don't think there were any murders or assault firsts in there. Am I correct on that?
Correct. We had about 6,000 case backlog.
How big of an accomplishment was it to clear that backlog? And then what are you doing to prevent it from building up again like that?
First of all, I I've got to give the shout out to the attorneys and support staff in our office in this subject. When we talked initially about the 6,000 case backlog, we put it out to all of them and said, hey, this is us. What are we going to do? These people came in on Saturdays. We would have all day pizza lunches. The office did not pay for it, just so nobody criticizes. We do all day Saturdays, and people would just come in and go through piles and piles of cases because everybody wanted a positive start. Everybody wanted to take care of the backlog. We do not have a backlog now, and that goes to the efficiency. We don't let them build up. We get a lot of cases. I mean, it takes a lot of hard work, but it was the staff who agreed to come in on Saturdays and Sundays and take care of that backlog.
As an office within St. Louis County, you are not immune to the pressures from the county budget. I'm wondering how those across-the-board cuts have affected your office and might impact the progress that you have made.
Well, it's significant. I mean, 99% of our budget goes to salaries. So any cuts are detrimental. We've had about a 5% cut in our budget. It is very, very important that we don't let that affect public safety, and we are committed to that. There are people playing double roles, maybe work in treatment court, as well as do general felonies now. We had to cut two non-attorney positions, which I hated doing. They were important positions, but when your budget gets cut, you have to do it. Not only was it painful because these are important people in the office, but we are not going to let that affect public safety.
How do you balance people willing to take on that double workload, like you mentioned, with burnout, with things slipping through the system simply because they're, you know, carrying, like you said, a double load?
Well, again, it's the staff that's willing to do that. They have stepped up. They know the importance. You know, I do want to refer to one thing you said, which was burnout. You know, years ago when I was only working on sexual assault and child abuse, people would ask me a lot, does it affect you emotionally or does it ever mess with you? And for some reason, as a younger prosecutor, I would always say no. I felt that in order to look strong, I should say no. And recently I have realized that was the wrong answer, because it does affect us. So I have also been very aware that there are probably attorneys in my office who feel that they shouldn't talk about when it affects them negatively or when they have burnout. So because of that, we are actually in the process of creating a wellness unit, because it's very, very important that anybody working in any role, but talking about in our office, that they also take care of themselves. Because like you said, burnout is rough, but also some of the stuff that the attorneys in our office see, the stuff that I see, it's okay for us to say, yeah, sometime that really messes with me, so let's address it.
Is Levi the courtroom dog an honorary member of that wellness team? Please say yes.
Yes, Levi is incredible. Levi, I will tell you, is turning 10 in
July. Oh, my goodness. So well, there has to be a new Levi,
yes.
I'm assuming, at some point?
Yes.
Okay.
Levi has to retire soon. Levi has been a game changer for our office. This dog, the way we interact with especially child victims and adult victims if they want to, when we sit with the child and talk about gruesome details, it is so different than sitting across a table talking, as opposed to that child sitting on the floor with a big floppy dog next to him and sometimes even telling Levi their problems. We have also been allowed to let Levi actually into trials where a child can take him all the way up to the witness stand. And we're in the process of getting a new, we hate to let Levi go, but Levi
deserves a retirement.
He deserves
That's
a retirement.
70 plus years in human years for him.
He's amazing. But we will, once Levi decides to retire, we will have a new baby to support our victims. And we are so grateful to Duo Dogs for training dogs who do this incredible work.
How have some of the federal immigration policies affected the work of the prosecutor's office?
At this point, I'm grateful to say, it has not had any effect on us.
How does the office interact with Immigration and Customs Enforcement?
We have had no interaction with Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Their interaction is primarily with the feds, whether that be the U.S. Attorney's Office, whether that be the Attorney General's Office. It's very scary what's going on in this country. We have not had any interaction.
What are some of the new tools and technologies that you've put in place to help with making the office more efficient or reducing some of that back-end workload for your attorneys?
You ask the best questions. I am so, so, so proud of this. When a police officer applies on a case, they used to have to physically come into our office and sit
which
down.
Which is in Clayton, right?
Which is in Clayton.
So you're if you're coming from Baldwin or Afton or Castle Point up north.
Exactly. Now, if someone has what we call an in custody, a case that needs to be reviewed right now, because an individual can only be held 24 hours before charges are issued, we call that an in custody. That officer has to come in. However, now, and they used to either have to come in or send a packet, snail mail. Now they do it all online. Our attorneys are able to get it right out electronically right from online. They're able to review it right there, make the charging decision, let the officer know. Everything is done online, so the officer doesn't have to spend hours on those cases sitting with an attorney. The other thing we've done, which has made efficiency so wonderful and St. Louis County safer, we've started in partnership with the courts an easy warrant system. It used to be where, say, a police officer was on scene of a murder even, they would have to come to our office with a search warrant and get it signed and then go to the judge. In the middle of the night, the last 18 years with I as a prosecutor, if something violent like that happened in the middle of the night, the police officer would have to literally drive to the prosecutor's house, get it reviewed, prosecutor would sign it, they then would drive to the judge's house.
So law and order is occasionally accurate in terms of driving up to the judge's door and getting a signature on a warrant.
You know what? I hear people say all the time it's not, and then whenever I watch it, which isn't very frequently, I'll think, oh, wow, this is accurate. But now it's all done through easy warrant. Now a police officer who is at a murder scene who needs a search warrant, he doesn't have to leave. He doesn't have to leave the street and drive to my house at 3 a.m. He does it all electronically. He or she do it all electronically. These officers stay in the community now, stay in these scenes. They don't have to leave to get a warrant signed. It's still reviewed just as accurately by our prosecutor, by the judge, but it can be done without that officer leaving the community.
Where do you see the role of artificial intelligence in the prosecutor's office?
To be quite honest, artificial intelligence terrifies me. In terms of crimes, we have already seen it in terms of child pornography, where we will see child pornography, but it's artificial intelligence, but real children's faces are on those bodies. We've also seen it where the entire thing is artificial intelligence, a child pornography. It's still child pornography. But that concerns me, especially the use of real people's faces worked in. And I would assume artificial intelligence is only going to grow, and we have to be prepared to how we move forward, how police respond to that, how we issue charges. I think it's terrifying. We'll be ready to handle it because we're aware of it.
And in terms of it as a tool within your office, do you have policies around you can't use ChatGPT for a warrant or to, you know, write up a probable cause statement? What are the, or not a probable cause, a charging document? What are the boundaries that you guys have set on your office's use of artificial intelligence?
Yeah, we don't use it for anything we write. I know that police departments are constantly being approached about different systems of writing police reports. I know that's something that they are having to decide and make decisions about. In terms of our office, we don't use it to write motions, responses, anything like that.
Where are the state laws falling short in terms of giving you the tools to prosecute, let's say, the AI-generated child sexual assault material?
I think statutes are going to have to evolve with AI and be more specific, because if I go back to work this afternoon and we get an application for possession of child pornography and it's all AI, it's still child pornography, but I'm sure there will be issues with that because it's not real on any level, but the statutes will have to keep up with that. There's a lot of work being done in Jeff City regarding juvenile crimes. You know, so often when I go speak to groups, they will say to me, what are you doing about the juveniles? Because we are very aware our adult offenders will basically get the juveniles to do the dirty work because they know that there's nothing we can do. But when people say to me, what are you doing about the juveniles? We have almost no control of juveniles. We deal with 18 and over. The only time we...
Is it 18 or 17? I know that
it's
they
18
had...
Now.
Okay, all right.
Yes.
They're talking about making it younger for some, I think. It was
17.
Okay.
And it's 18 now. The problem is when people say, hey, there's so many juvenile crimes, there are. Or I'll be at home at night watching the news and they'll say there was some sort of vicious crime and the suspect is 17. And I'll realize there's nothing we can do. Now, if the juvenile court certifies them as an adult, then they come to us. There's a lot of changes in juvenile law right now where we will ultimately have a say in asking the juvenile court, hey, will you certify this individual? The new laws in juvenile will also allow us to see a juvenile history. When I get a case of an 18-year-old, all the years I've worked in this office, they may have a huge juvenile history, even a violent history. I have never been privy to that. I will see it as somebody who's never committed a crime. With the new laws, I will now, or my prosecutors will now be able to look at juvenile history.
You mentioned the emerging public safety challenges, AI-generated child sexual assault material. What are some of the other challenges that you are seeing in the office that you're having to continuously pivot to address?
Well, you know, one thing we do address is that this is a, St. Louis is a region. We have the same, the criminals who commit the crime in the city are the same ones who commit them here. So one of the very important things that we have to address on a regular basis is working with Gabe Gore in the city, working with Joe McCullough in St. Charles, because...
And I'd imagine even Illinois counterparts, too.
Of course.
There are bridges.
There are bridges.
A couple of them are closed right now, but there are bridges.
And these offenders don't stop at an imaginary line. And oftentimes our offenders will have cases in several different areas. So not only do we have cases and say, hey, I have this case, you have this case, same offender, we also work together on our policies. Because in order to make St. Louis County safe, I know St. Louis City has to be safe. St. Charles has to be safe. We all have to work together with these policies. We want people to stay in St. Louis. We want businesses to come to St. Louis. My kids are 21 and 23. I want them to want to stay in St. Louis. I don't want them to say, I'm going to move to a safer, cooler city. So I want them to be able to buy a house here. I want them to feel safe here. I want them to be able to go to a Cardinal game without me tracking them on my phone every 5 minutes because I'm nervous. We need to attract businesses because that's how people are going to move here. They're going to stay here if St. Louis County is safe and vibrant and attracts people and businesses. So it's very important that we work together as a region.
Politically Speaking is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, part of the University of Missouri St. Louis. St. Louis County Prosecuting Attorney Melissa Price-Smith, anything else that you'd like to add for our listeners?
I just thank you so much for allowing me to be here. I love talking about the office. The office is growing, is so strong. We have made so many huge strides the past year, and we're just getting started, and we are dedicated.
Until next time, so long.
Support comes from Mosby Building Arts, creating laundry rooms with improved storage, workspace, and everyday function for one of the home's most used spaces. Inspiration at callmosby.com.